I'm looking at, in the purple folder here, two versions, I suppose. One is the House and one is the Senate. We don't have a Senate. We don't have a side-by-side. My understanding is, however, there's only one real substantive difference, and that's whether to apply the Federal Soldiers and Sailors Civil Relief Act to businesses that are, thank you, wholly owned by the service members to which this would apply. There may be some other language changes in the bills. I'm not sure. But I think those will all just be technical and minor. And I think we could just ask staff to make a recommendation on how to consolidate them in a way that makes the most sense. And we've had some chance to discuss the one provision that's at issue, and I think if we look at the House file, it's Section 1. Mm-hmm. And in the Senate file, it's...
It's deleted.
Okay. Well, I can try. And I know that there was... This, I believe, came about in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The issues were raised. And it may be that Senator Betzold or Harrison Rose could address what some of the concerns
are. Mr. Chair. I'll address the issues as they came up in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Servicemen's Civil Relief Act, just by way of history, was passed around World War II. The whole intention was to give, to respect the rights of individuals who went into the service of the country. It didn't matter how they went in, whether they're drafted, whether they enlisted, how long they stayed in, because they did not want to put individuals who would set aside their civilian lives to go into the service of their country and now be disadvantaged, you know, having creditors going after them, you know, having, you know, various legal issues coming on up. They wanted the protections for these individuals while they were in military service. So that is the whole purpose of it. Now, the federal law has been updated since then, and, you know, as times have changed and even the name was changed from the Soldiers, the Sailors, Civil Relief Act, the Servicemen, Civil Relief Act. So, and you have a summary, I believe, of some of the many, many protections that are given within the federal law. So, you know, it's possible we may not even necessarily need to pass a state law, although sometimes there's gaps in there, some things to protect service members. The concern that we had about Article 1 is it appears to go well beyond protecting the individual's rights while that individual is off in military service, because it applies to any business wholly owned by the service member or the service member's spouse. Again, if the purpose of the act is to protect the rights of the member, you're now applying some very broad laws to service members or the service member's spouse that could be used perhaps to the detriment of customers of a business. It isn't clear whether or not the business has to be, I'll say, a sole proprietorship, or it could be a corporation. And it actually, in my view, goes contrary to what the intent of the federal law was. For instance, under the federal law, a service member could, for instance, void a contract if the contract is entered into prior to the person going into military service. If you enter a contract after military service, you can't break it. But if it's before military service, you can. Well, presumably there's businesses that have contracts, and why would a business be allowed to break a contract by the service member or the service member's spouse who may be back here running businesses? Why would the service member's spouse be able to just break contracts simply because, you know, the state of Minnesota said you can apply the federal law here? And there's just so much within the federal law that we just felt really uncomfortable, and we felt that this was a broad expansion of the intent of the federal law, so we felt it was in our interest to delete that section from the bill, and that is why the Senate Judiciary Committee went in that direction.
Mr. Chair, the other thing that happened in terms of the process of this whole thing, and Ben was very great to sit in every single committee, I think, along with me, but actually just sort of skipped right over in all the committees. Their attention was focused on Section 2 and the whole rest of the thing. And we had, as we went through many, many committees, We got into very detailed discussions about the range of a cell phone because we were mostly focusing on personal contracts, you know, cell phone contracts and health club contracts, and if you were renting to own furniture and you know, all of that sort of thing. So it was these personal contracts, and committee members had lots and lots of questions about, well, then what about this, and what if this, and what if this, and this. And they were had lots of questions, and Brian Brexen and Ben Wadsel did a great job of fielding all of those questions. But those were many committees' worth of discussion simply around the personal contracts. And we never got into any discussion about these rights being extended to a business until we hit the very last committee. And the judicial guys with their eyes for using these little paragraphs said, well, what's going on in number one here? And, you know, frankly, we stumbled a little bit. And we're scrambling for legal help that day. And when I realized, too, and this is, I'll accept a lot of responsibility for this, when I realized what this first paragraph did, man, this is a whole field that we have not plowed in terms of discussion on committee. Because everyone's had very detailed questions about all these other types of contracts. I just did not feel prepared at all to move forward with this provision in here. And I suggested that if we would pull this out and return next session with another bill, then we could discuss all the many different kinds of rights and implications and use of private lands that are going to be now accorded to the service member and the service member's spouse. So at this point, I felt like Section 2 and on had been thoroughly discussed by all the different committees, and Section 1 just seriously needed to be removed.
Okay. Well, it may be that the House is a less deliberative body than the Senate, I suppose, but we didn't actually have sort of the kind of thorough questioning of all the sections of the bill in the committees that we went through. And the Section 1 in the House version of the bill was something that House Research reported solved a problem that had been ongoing for a lot of businesses had affected by the Iraq and Afghanistan deployments, especially, particularly, I know that there was one case, I think, where a business basically forfeited, I think, something like $50,000 just because it couldn't get any kind of civil relief because it was not owned by the individual. And maybe one of the reasons we didn't get as involved in Section 1 is that, from my point of view, I don't know the numbers, but my assumption would be that the vast majority of businesses are sole proprietorships, the small business type, without any kind of formal corporate type organization. No, not an LLC, not an S-Corp, not a C-Corp. And the individual, in that sense, signs for everything that the business does. It really is the obligation of the individual. It could be called a business or styled a business, but really it's the individual. And in that way, the federal protections would apply to that individual's business in the same way it would just to them as an individual. And so we were really looking at the difference, I thought, between a sole proprietorship versus somebody who creates a corporate entity of some kind and owns all the stock themselves. My assumption, and maybe we would need to vet this a bit more, but my assumption would be that corporations that are wholly owned by an individual or an individual spouse tend to be much smaller and obligations fewer than something where there's, you know, many people who have, even if it's privately held, where there are many people who own a piece of the corporation. So I think that was some of the assumptions going in that we had to this. And then we did have, and as you saw and you referred to, an overview of the Service Members Civil Relief Act provisions that would be relevant here. And you know, without going through each piece in detail as I read it over, I didn't see anything that would be revolutionary for a small business to be affected by it. So that was kind of some of the thoughts going into the House version. And I know today Mr. Rohrdance from the Attorney General's Office, who is a JAG officer, is here and prepared to discuss how some of this would affect businesses, if it might be helpful to discuss that a bit more. I know one of the issues of the Judiciary Committee was that they didn't have somebody who is well-versed in the legal aspects of this to discuss it, but perhaps we can remedy that to some degree just by hearing from Mr. Rorty.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would be interested in hearing that. I'm also a retired JAG officer myself, and so I'm quite familiar with the Act. And if you'll, for instance, if you'll note on the very last page, Section 596 of the federal law provides, you know, that if a citizen has obligations or liabilities for which he is personally liable, then the assets, you know, may not even be available to use to satisfy those obligations. And so I think the federal law is cognizant of some situations. If I can share just one small anecdote of my own, I had a friend of mine who was deployed in the Gulf War in 1991, and he was a lawyer, sole proprietor, and he was able to use various parts of the Act because he was deployed, and so he had to break his lease. He was allowed to do that. He had to restructure some finances, some of the obligations that he had, and they were all available for him. But and all within the purview of the Act. Now, as a matter of fact, I mean, it was a short war, but by being deployed, even a few months, he wound up staying over there because basically his law practice was ruined. By farming out his cases to other people, by the time he came back, he had nothing left. And he spent a couple of years trying, you know, to resurrect it to no avail, and ultimately gave up. But so even though he had the protections there, the fact is, you know, his business was gone, and so, you know, I think that there are certain things we have to be cognizant of. I just felt that, again, you know, if I don't see, and you know, I'll be interested in hearing the testimony, but I don't see what this expansion does that's not in the federal law, and in fact, could not this be used in ways that the federal law never anticipates? So I'll be certainly interested in hearing that too.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Bessel. I guess one last point before we call it Mr. Rordance, and that would be that the friend that you had was able to take advantage of some of these protections because it was a sole proprietorship. If he had happened to be in a partnership with somebody else and had half the caseload, none of the things that he was able to take advantage of, which ultimately destroyed his law practice, could equally or almost to an equal extent destroy some kind of a partnership, particularly if it was with a spouse. So I think there's clearly an argument here for expanding these to a wholly owned business. And how that plays out is maybe something Mr. Rordance could address.
But, and Mr. Chair, that's precisely the point. I think it goes in far different areas that we weren't quite prepared to go into, and it certainly was not going to be a consent calendar issue.
Again, the Senate is more deliberative.
Yeah. Yeah.
But maybe Mr. Rordance could come and talk about this. Mr. Rordance, just please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, sir. Chuck Rordance, Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Minnesota Attorney General Lori Swanson, Mr. Chair, Senators, Representative. Thank you for allowing me to come and speak with you this morning. I certainly understand Senator Betzold's concerns about this provision being extended beyond the intended scope of the Service Members Civil Relief Act. When you start talking about, when you start getting beyond individuals and into wholly owned businesses, that certainly sends up a red flag. The first thing, a little bit about myself. I was a JAG attorney at Edwards Air Force Base, the secondary base for where they land the space shuttle. I advised soldiers and airmen being deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq, most of whom were between 18 and 22 years of age, some of whom were older with families and young children. The Service Members Civil Relief Act, formerly the Soldiers and Sailors Civil Relief Act, I always looked at it as a shield. It's not a sword. It's not the kind of thing that service members, savvy business members, might use to frustrate contracts. It is an effort to shield service members temporarily from debt collection and from actions in court
against their family members while they're deployed. It does not extinguish debts. It does not extinguish liabilities. It delays them. And also allows for interest to accrue while those debts are stayed. By expanding coverage of the federal law to spouses and their children and wholly owned businesses, the federal law itself has a mechanism within it so that a judge, if a service member's or their family's ability to pay is not materially affected by the service member's service, then the judge can basically say, look, you don't qualify, the family and kids and wholly owned business, you don't qualify for protection under the Act. Your obligations are due. And we talk about, this being a corporation, a business. If it is such that a service member and their spouse own a corporation that is sufficient in size, that's not just your mom and pop shops, first of all, they may still have the resources to cover those bills, in which case a court would allow the creditor to proceed against that company. If not, again, what we're talking about is we're not extinguishing the liabilities of that company. We're talking about delaying it.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask a question.
See.
The summary we have says that there are cases where judgments can be reasonably set aside, but you're saying it's just stayed. Under what circumstances can debts actually be set aside or vacated? Or are we just talking about judgments can be vacated? The debts, though, continues.
Thank you, sir. that provided clarity for me too. Yes, I believe that is the case. The judgment can be vacated. I mean, essentially, what this is doing is this is preventing a judgment creditor from proceeding against the spouse of a service member, a spouse who most likely has small children at home or very likely has dependents. And can't make the court date because she can't find child care.
I understand that.
And it vacates any default judgment, but the debt would still be outstanding.
So under no circumstances would the federal law allow the extinguishment of the debt. It just stays postponed.
That's my understanding. I'd have to follow up on that, but I have reviewed case law, and I have not seen where the debt was. I mean, it's not a bankruptcy.
Right.
It's just a stay.
Well, the summary, Mr. Chair, also, at the bottom of page one, vacation or setting aside default judgments. Typically, anybody's under a judgment, you have to sign an affidavit that says that the person is not in the military. And if you wind up, which is misunderstood, because, if the debt was incurred while the person was in the military, it doesn't matter because the person doesn't have these protections. But if somehow somebody got a default judgment because, the service member was away and then the service member finds out about it, there is a process by which the judgment can be vacated so that the service member has time to get back and then defend against it. It doesn't extinguish the debt, but it does vacate a judgment if it was entered in violation of the individual's rights. My concern, Mr. Chair, the language that we have before us doesn't talk about, a spouse having small children at home and not making court dates. Nothing in here says that. We're talking about applying parts of federal law that allows you to stay the lawsuit. Just, you can't even bring the lawsuit, tolling the statute of limitations, terminating leases, doing all kinds of things, and I don't know why a spouse who's back home running a business should be entitled to all those things. Just because all of a sudden they qualify. You are correct, Mr. Chair. The Act is more of a defense mechanism. I mean, none of these rights, like any other rights, none of them come into play unless somebody invokes them. If the service member says, okay, I understand, I've got the debt, I'll pay it, the service member can do that. If the I'll give you another example, Gulf War one, where a service member was deployed, had an apartment that he leased, and faithfully paid the rent back to his landlord every month that he was deployed. Then he came back home, and then, only then did he actually read the materials that said he could have broken the lease. Well, it was too late to do anything about it because, you know, he agreed to do that. But had he shown up the day that he got the orders and said, gave it to his landlord and said, I'm breaking this lease, he could have done that. Now, would we be allowed to break leases just because the spouse back here wants to break some lease? I don't know that we want to do that.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these are the kinds of discussions I think committees at many different levels need to have for the body, and once I can feel that it's been thoroughly discussed and gone through, although we certainly trust lawyers, and I know that the federal law has been gone over with a fine-tooth comb, and it's been in existence for quite a long time. Once again, the difference is shifting from a personal application to the business application. And I'll just throw out to, and I'm not a lawyer here at all, so I'm totally out of my depth, but I'll just throw out a couple examples. If you would apply these rights to businesses, back in Winona, my husband and I own some rental houses. We rent to college kids. And if, for example, I was called up, or my husband was called up, we could break the leases with all of our tenants and essentially make dozens of kids homeless during the school year. And in a small community, there's limited housing, and you sign on a certain date, and there's a rental cycle. And what protection is there for renters if a service member or a spouse is a landlord who just decides, I just can't deal with this, there's too much going on in my life, I'm breaking my leases, I'm just going to sell all my houses or my apartments. If I can come up with one example like that, and then I'm worrying about the well-being of my renters, that's just one example that we haven't even discussed. Another thing could be, and I represent lots of small towns, and in a small town, we have lots of mom-and-pop organizations that provide busing and transportation for the school districts. Same sort of thing. You enter into 1, 2, 3, and 5-year school busing contracts with the school districts, and if a member is called up, now, probably the people are not going to up and sell their business, but what if they did? This gives them the right to break the contract with the school district in the middle of the year, and what is the district going to do with busing? So, I mean, there's just lots and lots of examples of do we want to make sure this is applied here but not here? Or if it's this, then it has to be this, this, and this. So when I come up with some of those scenarios, I think, boy, we just need a lot more discussion. And I think everyone in the Senate thoroughly understands and supports the family needs and the business needs of our servicemen who are called up. So it's not that we're resistant to going there, it's just that we need a lot more discussion before we...
Thank you, Senator. And Mr. Royans, you could correct me if I'm wrong. I believe you said that there is essentially a sort of a need-based, that you or the person on the other side of this can challenge the need of the service member, or in this case the business, to invoke the provisions of the federal act. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chair, Senators. This is... We would like to see this provision added now. I'll just be upfront about that. I mean, there are service members over there right now putting their lives on the line, and in my opinion, this is a low-threat way to send a very strong message to them saying, we've got your back. We've got your back while you're over there.
Mr. Chair, could you give us specific examples? I mean, trying to invoke that kind of rhetoric doesn't really give me the information. We've been asking for this for a while. Okay. And I don't think that this is helpful at all. You haven't given me a single example of how this is needed. Please do so.
I apologize, Senator. Each of the examples that you provided, there is a provision, there is a mechanism in the federal courts and translated to the state courts whereby the courts will prevent any mom and pop shop or larger corporation from using this provision for their financial benefit. Their ability to pay must be materially affected by the service member's service. And a court can delve into the finances, can delve into whether the bus company can actually pay those debts, or if the service member's service makes that company unable to compete, unable to honor the obligations of that contract. I mean, otherwise, the corporation is going to fail anyways.
Mr. Rodans, if I could break in. I think what we're really talking about here is who bears a burden of risk. And if you have a provision that as Mr. Rodans has testified, that prohibits using this as a sword, in effect, or through a hearing and a determination that can only be used to protect them in certain circumstances. Frankly, if a school district enters into a busing contract with a company and the service member deployment overseas prohibits them from being able to live up to the terms of that contract, not providing this protection doesn't serve either party's interest. And similarly with the renters, if students are renting and the person is unable to maintain or continue to administer property, sure, they can enter into some sort of administration with an outside company, and that's maybe what is in their financial best interest. But the question is, who should bear the burden of service in that sense? Should you provide a provision where, in these cases, you can actually pass some of the risk on to the person on the other side of the contract, or should the person who is serving in the military overseas risking their life be the only ones to bear that? I think that's really what this comes down to.
Well, Mr. Chair, you don't have to be deployed to a war zone. I mean, you can be deployed to Florida. I mean, you know, whatever it is. And it's still up to the service member to prove, the burden is on the service member to prove that the deployment or the military service materially affected their ability to fulfill these things. Now, the thing of it is, we've been all been talking hypotheticals. It'd be kind of nice if somebody came up with any real examples of how somebody who served in the service of the country and the person's spouse needed this proposal, and because it wasn't in law, it was to their detriment. I've just been hearing hypotheticals up until this point. And if the Attorney General's office can't come up with at least one concrete example, I think we ought to just hold it off and, you know, wait till something comes up that we can actually point and say, okay, now you've made your case. So far, I haven't heard anything.
Mr. Sayers from House Research actually, I think, could provide at least one specific example, perhaps more, but I know that he has been looking at a number of proposals or has seen a number over the years to try to address this issue, so he could perhaps help us out a bit.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, the one example that I recalled, at least vaguely, was a case of a fairly large farmer and his family in southern Minnesota. The farmer was called off to war and served roughly 18 months in active duty, and during that time made the claim that he and his spouse were materially affected by the active duty in their ability to pay their operating loan or to repay their operating loan, and he asked the lender to lower the interest rate to 6%, and the lender took a look at it and said, no, and here I'm on thin ice. I'm sorry, I don't have a business background, but the lender said something to the effect that no, the loan is fairly large, and it's a business loan. It's a business loan to you and your family. It's not a personal loan, and that's where my understanding is rather vague. But the farmer then, the soldier, when he returned, was not able to get the benefit of that lowered interest rate. And it was, since it was a fairly large loan, it made quite a difference to him. That's the one example I do recall.
Mr. Chair, Section 527 sets a maximum rate of interest to 6%. And, of course, this is mainly intended if interest rates are higher than 6%. But it isn't, I don't know that the federal law says that distinguishes the kind of loans. The idea here is that if an individual goes to the military service and you've got financial obligations, the assumption is what the military pays you is going to be less than what you're making as a civilian. And so they try to allow you to go in and adjust it. Now, what happened in that particular fact situation, I don't know, but it seems to me that's already covered by federal law. And the fact that, it was a farm, or however they characterize it, I don't know that changed it. So I don't think that instance, I think that's already covered in federal law.
Senator Bessel, I sort of get the feeling that we're going to be revisiting this issue perhaps in the next session, but I would say that, in regard to that, to the real situation, the difference would be if the farm was incorporated in some way and the corporation held a loan, the federal act would provide no relief. Whereas if the farm wasn't incorporated and the individual was the one who incurred the obligation, then the federal act would protect them. And that would seem to me a fairly arbitrary distinction.
And Mr. Chair, if that is the difference, then we need to have a lot of discussion on that point, because there are differences in corporations, small corporations, large corporations, and the language here does not make that distinction. And I think that it does open a lot of questions here, and I think we have to be very cautious and ask a lot of questions before we pass something like this.
That was my understanding of the Senate position. And it doesn't seem like there's been a great deal of a change from our discussions, perhaps even
more hesitancy, if anything.
Greater hesitancy. I guess the question then would be, Mr. Cleary drafted four amendments, different approaches to try to provide some kind of relief for businesses, one of which narrowed the scope of the federal protections that would be extended. I assume that simply narrowing the number of provisions wouldn't really change that, because you'd want to have a discussion and evaluate the merits of each one. Another amendment would narrow the application to service members who are a member of the National Guard, which I take would not address your concern.
I'm a former Army reservist.
it says or other military reserves.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Discriminate, and another amendment would narrow the application to a term to a small business, which is a term defined in the amendment. But again, that would seem to me to kind of fly into the blades of the discussion that you think we need to have. And so my sense, unless you would care to correct me, is that none of these amendments would change the Senate belief of the need for further deliberation.
That's my sense, Mr. Chair. And again, I would like to state that the Senate is aware, and I think certainly very sympathetic of the fact that we have families and family-owned businesses and service members who have entered into a variety of contracts, in their personal world and in their professional world, and that we really need to do something to try to protect those people. As you're saying, I think the description of the shield and the sword is apt. And yet, in order to, again, bridge over between the personal realm into the professional and business world, I think we need to have a lot more discussion and find out if there are areas that we want to just go ahead and say this would work, and others where we need to craft some other language that are going to catch some of the people who may be affected by having the contracts canceled in their life that are not service-related. And at the same time, trying to do everything we can for service members. And, so I think we're ready and willing to try to get to the same endpoint that you guys are envisioning, and yet we just need some more discussion.
And Senator Ropes, did you have, and you think you had adequate discussion of the other sections of the bill?
Yes, we feel very comfortable. They cleared all of our committees. And Senator Neville?
Well, it appears from the discussion that the Servicemen's Civil Relief Act does not apply to corporations, then. It only applies to the servicemen to the extent they guarantee loans or co-sign debt, things like that. But we have two places else in the bill, sections 2 and 3, where we define service member as including business entities wholly owned by the service member or the service member's spouse. Senator, that's all the, given the discussion, one of them is on section 2, subdivision 1, right at the end.
What are you looking for? Senate file?
The House file?
The House file.
Section 2?
With respect to wireless contracts, we're defining service member as including business entities, and with respect to rental service clubs, memberships, service member also includes business and that's owned either by them or the spouse. Do you think that that creates an issue given the discussion we just had?
Yes.
Yes. Should that be, Mr. Chair, should that language possibly be also narrowed, and then so that we can preserve the question about the business entities next year?
Representative, Ms. Wall, Senator Pesley, you can answer your question.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think that Senator Neville is absolutely correct. It appears that the phrase service member includes any business wholly owned by the service member. It appears a couple of times. I count 1, 2, 3, 4 times it appears within this bill. And I don't know, and maybe Mr. Cleary could help us, is the House language and the Senate language, are they identical in all, except for Section 1, are they identical in all other respects, or there still are the differences?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Neville, that's my understanding, is that from the reviser as well, that with that exception, the language is identical. And if it's a consensus of the conference committee, I'm not sure I heard that yet, but if it is a consensus to drop Section 1 in the House bill, it would seem that one would have to drop those four statements as well for purposes of this section.
Representative, I guess a clarification, if either from Mr. Cleary or maybe somebody from the AG's office, but in Section 3, when we're talking about the cancellation without penalties of wireless contracts, and it defines a service member, it includes any business entity wholly owned by the service member, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that like, say I owned a mechanic shop and I was a member of the military and my cell phone was signed out to the business, not to me. I have a personal cell phone, but if my company also issued a cell phone, maybe I'm not being clear, but okay, so I think that's kind of where the language is at for this, is if I owned a business that gave me a cell phone. I don't...
Who are you asking?
Let's just give him clarification.
I think you're correct.
So I guess the nervousness about that language, I guess my statement is I'm not nervous about that language when it's related to that part. And I'll go back to being a silent member.
That's the other committee.
Oh, that's the other one.
I mean, that would be another possibility. Rather than striking that language, they're relatively straightforward provisions, and... Yeah. The concern primarily is one of analysis and discussion. This apparently has been pretty thoroughly discussed through the Senate committee process, and we may be able to provide those, leave those provisions in there right now. They're pretty straightforward. It doesn't.
Well, Mr. Chair, as I recall the Senate discussion, we too had focused on the other areas of the bill. And the last part that we focused on was Section 1, and I don't recall that we then went back to pick up the language in, it looks like, 3 and 4, right. But it seems to me that if Section 1 is deleted,
then the reference is to a service member includes any business entity wholly owned by the service member or service member's spouse, you know, should be also deleted as well, too. I mean, if that's the direction we're going in. I think that, you know, you can't just delete Section 1 without addressing those items that specifically tie into it in Section, the other sections here.
Senator Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Betzel, if it is pretty tight in terms of what we talked about in Section 3 with just simply the wireless contracts, people are losing their landlines now just going to wireless. And if you have a small business and you have a wireless contract for that business, although you carry it around your pocket at home, I don't know that we could not, I couldn't include them. The wholly owned businesses in some of these more tightly conscribed contract areas.
But Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, I think that it now gets us right into the very areas that, you know, I think at least I have some concerns about expanding the personal rights into businesses. And so I don't know that I'm comfortable going that direction. I don't know what other members of the conference committee feel, but I'm concerned about that.
Mr. Chairman, the House Research did not draft this bill, so I can't say what was intended, but I think a strict reading of that clause would give it the same effect as if Subdivision 1 were included in the bill. I would think that to be consistent, if the conference committee is going to delete Subdivision 1, it would have to delete that statement wherever it appears. Mr. Chairman, would it be helpful to ask the Attorney General what was intended?
Mr. Rordance, do you have an opinion on whether we could leave in place the definition of service member within these other two sections while striking Section 1?
Mr. Chair, Senators, Representative, I think we can. And also the other point I would make is that with the wireless contracts, this is essentially codifying what already exists under the federal law for credit cards. And in that a credit card, if you've got a small business where the husband and wife are applying for a credit card in the name of the business, they both put their names individually on the credit card application. And essentially under the Civil Relief Act, it provides that shield to those individuals. And essentially, it operates in the exact same fashion as the wireless contracts and the ability to modify or cancel those contracts. So I think absolutely this provision being maintained in Section 3 would essentially cause it to operate the exact same way as credit card contracts work under the federal law.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would go back to Section 1. I'll give it as broad. You know, I can understand, and obviously there's not going to be an agreement to, you know, you're going to lose that battle. But the other thing is the two sections regarding the wireless phone or the rental club, travel, whatever, that's so tight and so specific. And it's dealing with if I owned a company, yet I had to go to a conference in California and I was called up to be able to cancel that if I owned that small business. So I think it's tight to leave, and to leave that in there is fine, but, I mean, Section 1 is broad.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Senator Neville.
It's really not broad. If you look at, I'm looking at, what is this house file?
That's the Senate language.
I'm looking at the Senate language. The definition of service contract is television, computer, internet, or any other type of service. That's pretty broad. So, basically, unless you're buying a piece of equipment, or you got a mortgage, you know, so some kind of debt, almost anything else is going to be considered a service. I think that's pretty broad, and perhaps
we can't envision all of the ways that it could be used right now.
I'm counting up the votes here, and I suggest that then we would probably want to adopt we can adopt the House language, or actually we can just adopt the Senate language.
Well, it's a House, Mr. Chair, it's a House file, so we probably ought to, and it's my understanding, again, there really aren't any, beyond Section 1, there are no other differences between the two? Is that correct? Okay, then, Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion. I'll move that we adopt from the House file here at 532, Section 2, Section 3, with the exception of the sentence on line 3.7 and 3.8 that says service member includes any business entity wholly owned by the service member or the service member's spouse. So I'm not moving that language, but the rest of Section 3. I'll move Section 4, with the exception of the sentence on 3.24 and 3.25 for the purposes of Section service member includes, etc. And 3.32, delete for the purpose of subdivision service member includes any business, etc. And then on 4.7 or 4.8 for the purpose of subdivision service member includes any business entity, etc. And then Section 5. So I move again Sections 2 through 5 with those four sentences deleted.
Staff has the motion.
Mr. Chairman? I may have missed it, Senator Bessel, but I believe there's one more occurrence of that language in on the Senate bill. It's on lines 2.34 and 2.35 in Section 2.
I was looking at the House bill, so since it's a House file.
I think we actually did cover that, Mr. Clare.
That's right. You've got it covered.
Yeah, I think you hit all the four sections with that sentence. Any further discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion adopted. And I don't know that there's any other business before us.
Mr. Chairman, there is one more technical amendment. It comes from the revisor, and it concerns the last section on enforcement. According to the revisor, for that section to be properly codified, that amendment would be necessary. And it's being handed out right now. As I understand the revisor felt that over the years, given that Section 5 of the House bill is not codified, those responsible for enforcing it may lose track of that responsibility, and it would be far better in the revisor's judgment to include it in codified statutes. So it's a purely technical amendment. And that amendment is A07-0959, revisor.
I'll move that amendment. A07-0959.
Is there a discussion on the amendment?
I'll move that amendment.
Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I don't want to say anything, but what is 216B? What chapter of the law is that?
Mr. Cleary, I'm sorry. The question was, what is Section 216 or Chapter 216?
You know, I'm sorry, I have a hearing problem. There you go.
The question is, what is Chapter 216? What section?
Chapter 216. I think we've got it wrong. And is it straight 216? 216B.
216B. I'm going to guess that it's because it's relating to a utility as opposed to a...
Okay. And that is... That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Public Utilities Law.
Any further discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion's adopted. Is there, are there Mr. Clary or Senate staff or senators, any other?
That the bill is amended, the
all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and I think that's our last item of business, and the meeting is adjourned.